But I think there are some interesting questions around, is there a more coherent combined UK offer on supporting greater prosperity beyond just the provision of aid that, you know, would be interesting to get more detail on, and that's worth looking out for.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
Following Brexit, Britain has expressed a desire to play an important new role in world affairs. The old idea of global Britain has thus made a comeback, with free trade as its core element. Indeed, global Britain appears to be a catchy label for the UK's ambition to look beyond Europe for new commercial opportunities and pathways to global influence. But critics argue that a positive image of global Britain must be earned, not declared, and that the narrative of global Britain will only be meaningful if and when the ambitious vision is backed up with extra investments. Of particular concern to the global development community has been the recent cuts to the UK's aid budget, which some argue will adversely affect Britain's power and global influence. There's also been considerable criticism of the government's decision to merge the Department for International Development, or DFID, with the Foreign Office. To discuss the global Britain narrative, the merger of DFID with the Foreign Office, and the impact of aid cuts, I'm joined by Mark Miller, who's the director of the Overseas Development Institute's work on development and public finance. Mark's research interests include how states can build the capabilities to effectively manage their public finances and the future of development cooperation in the UK. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm delighted to have a chance to speak with you today, Mark. Welcome.
Great to be here, Dan. Thank you.
So, Mark, there's been considerable talk of late. There's this concept of global Britain. And in many speeches, your current Prime Minister, but also former Prime Minister Theresa May in 2016, 2017, there was this expression of hope in all of these speeches about how the UK will step up in the world, will offer a new type of leadership, the strongest, the most forceful form of leadership for business, for free markets, free trade, anywhere in the world. And Boris Johnson and his pro-Brexit allies have for long promised that once Britain broke free of the EU, Britain would indeed play a bold new role on the world stage. So you have all of these actors selling Brexit as some sort of a promise of a new Elizabethan age, you know, a British resurgence around the globe. And by leaving the EU, the UK was finally free to seek its destiny as global Britain. So let me begin by asking you to reflect on this narrative of global Britain. Where does this destiny lie, Mark? Is it a case of inspired vision or more a matter of wishful thinking?
Thanks, Dan. Well, I think there's probably two schools of thought on this. Maybe I can characterize a sympathetic view of global Britain and then perhaps a more skeptical view. So I think that the sympathetic view would be that, yes, the UK has left the European Union, but does still appear to be very committed to working on global challenges where the interests of people in the UK and internationally are aligned. So, you see this in climate change, where the government's hosting COP26 later this year. The UK, has recently made quite bold commitments around its nationally determined contribution. It's also, you know, can proudly point to the collaboration between Oxford University and AstraZeneca on the vaccine.
Right.
That, you know, have supported the global response to COVID. So there are some, you know, things the UK can credibly and proudly point to about how it is working to address global challenges. As well as leaving the EU, it continues to work with multilateral organisations. It's a, you know, remains a major supporter of the World Health Organization. It's the still the largest voluntary core funding contribution from the UK. It's still the largest funder of IDA. So I think we need to sort of recognise this, because I think often, particularly in the sort of circles that you and I speak in, where there is a, you know, a scepticism about the current government often, I think a lot of this is sort of overlooked. So that's perhaps the, you know, a sympathetic view that the UK can still, as a, you know, freed from the EU, can work more effectively multilaterally, address global challenges, et cetera, et cetera. I think a more sceptical view would be that global Britain is more about, dare I say, jingoism, nostalgia, even perhaps nativism. So you're seeing, for example, I think this week the UK will have the maiden voyage of HMS Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier being, which will go and sail to the South China Sea, indication of the UK's military power. You know, a lot has been done to essentially position this government as backing the left behind in the UK rather than the left behind abroad. So so if we think about the recent aid cuts, there was this was, you know, essentially a clear signal in what the Chancellor was saying, that we can't afford to continue to prioritize people abroad. Instead, we'll use our resources to support those at home. There's also some of the language that's been used around sort of our role as a trading nation. It almost feels a bit swashbuckling. So we have the, you know, new policies around free ports, which will essentially be about offering big tax incentives to set up, getting rid of regulations so that the UK is once again free to do trade with countries around the world. So, you know, there's those two camps there. And I think this probably, you know, reflects a bit the two faces of the Prime Minister in some senses, that he's happy to talk a good game as a, you know, as he did as the Mayor of London, sort of metropolitan, internationalist, supporter of global challenges, but at the same time present himself to certain voters as, you know, the champion of Brexit, an opponent of migration. So I think that the jury's still a bit open on what this global Britain actually sort of amounts to.
Yeah, so, you know, I've been often wondering about the current sources of British power and influence. And there is, of course, you know, many would say there is the influence from its colonial history, the establishment of this rather strange organization called the Commonwealth, a political organization of 54 countries. There's a lot of talk about how the Commonwealth countries are home to 2.4 billion people. Some argue that, you know, maybe the Commonwealth was intended to soften the blow of the loss of empire. And the most visible event, of course, are, you know, the Commonwealth Games. Not that anybody thinks it's a very high quality kind of event. But anyway, you know, neither the Games nor the Commonwealth are considered to be very influential at the moment. And others, as you were saying earlier, would argue that this new idea of global Britain is meant to actually resurrect these expressions of colonial nostalgia. There's this fear that Britain's status in the world is declining. But what is particularly interesting in this context, and you mentioned it briefly, is that while this narrative of global Britain is being promoted, London has undertaken this major restructuring of its diplomatic service and its international development agency, DFID, which is, you know, very well known and I would say, you know, a world leader in many ways in terms of foreign aid in promoting international development, etc. So DFID has been merged now with the Foreign Office. And this, I gather, has created considerable opposition, particularly in development circles. And I read in one of your ODI reports, I think it was by Nilima Gulrajani, and I quote, that this wholesale swallowing of development in the new FCDO is more akin to a hostile takeover than a union of equals. And this radical form of integration needs rethinking, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this merger on the one hand. On the other, and perhaps more importantly, on a daily basis, Mark, we hear of major cuts to aid programs that Britain has historically supported all over the world. In a way, you know, it seems to me there's a paradox that Britain wishes to be a global leader after Brexit and wishes to play a more important new role in world affairs. But at the same time, it is perhaps undermining one of the greatest sources of soft power and global influence, that is financial support for global development. So the question to you is, how significant do you think this shift has been? I understand that Boris Johnson wants to balance national interest, being a populist, that many accuse him of being, together with this new role. But how significant has this recent shift been in terms of the UK's role and leadership in relation to international development?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the timing and scale of the aid cuts have been particularly corrosive. You know, I think it's fair to say in recent years in the UK that the development discourse has been sort of overly dominated by this 0.7% figure, the 0.7% of ODA as a proportion of gross national income that the government committed to. The previous government, you know, initially in 2010 and then maintained in 2015. And this has come to take on almost a sort of totemic role in debates on development in the UK. And I think that's perhaps been slightly unhelpful. But what's clearly been much, much, much more unhelpful is that during this enormous global crisis, the UK, during the course of a single year, had to cut its aid budget from 0.7% to 0.5%.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as you say, this has led to essentially weekly headlines around 85% cuts to UNFPA, who support programs on sort of sexual and reproductive health, cuts to UNICEF. There was, I think, 50-60% cuts to humanitarian pledges for Yemen. And clearly, this is undermining the UK's leadership and moral authority on development issues. And the reason why these cuts have been so large is simply that if you try to make such a large change to the budget just over the course of a single year, there's already a large number of pre-existing commitments that it's very hard for the government to get out from. So previous commitments to the EU, to multilateral contributions through the World Bank, for example. And so that means that although on the kind of face of it, the needed cut is about 25-30%, we're actually seeing sort of 50-60% cuts. And, you know, as you say, that makes it very difficult for then Boris Johnson to credibly stand up and say, for example, in advance of the G7 summit, you know, use as a rallying cry, we're still doing quite a lot on aid, because the UK is. You know, what really galvanizes action is where you're able to say, you know, we're doing quite a lot and we're going to do more, because at this time, aid has rarely ever be needed so much as right now to solve the health crisis, to get recovery going, and so forth. So yeah, I totally agree. It's very problematic, that the aid cuts. I mean, I think there's then a separate issue of the merger, but perhaps, you know, we can come onto that separately.
You know, I was just thinking about this percentage of GNI that one uses to measure how generous our countries are. So in Norway, there's been a lot of debate, or, you know, let me rephrase it. Politicians seem to be more concerned about the 1% GNI target than the content of the aid sometimes, that there's a lot of political interest in parliament in terms of anytime there's any talk about that percentage being reduced. So the question is, in many ways, you know, I'm wondering, how generous is Britain now? I remember some of my colleagues actually in Malawi and in many other parts of the world some of them were reacting during this Brexit discourse, you know, when there was so much focus on, oh, you know, we need more money for the NHS and for health, etc. We have to look more inwards. A lot of my colleagues were then thinking, you know, maybe the UK is resembling a developing country. So the discourse doesn't seem to be that of a donor, but it's like, oh, all this poverty, all of this help that we need. What are your thoughts there in terms of, say, the kind of support the British public has for aid projects in relation to, say, what should be or how much of the money should be earmarked to be used within the country?
There's two really interesting points you raised there. I think, first of all, this you know, what should be the right, you know, is there a right number? I mean, you mentioned Norway and you know, 1%. And I suppose Norway, along with other Scandinavian countries, would have a history of relatively high taxation, relatively high public spending, government to play a role in redistributive fiscal policy, addressing inequality, and as part of that, a historical large and generous commitment to addressing inequalities abroad through its official development assistance budget. The UK, in some respects, doesn't have Scandinavian levels of taxation or public spending. It doesn't have American levels of taxation or public spending, but you know, it sits somewhere a bit in between. And so in some senses, 0.7%, which is internationally is actually quite high. I think it's sort of fifth or sixth among OECD donors. And it had been the only sort of G7 donor that had historically met the 0.7 target. I think the UK in some respects had been a bit of an outlier there at 0.7%. And I do think there is a legitimate political debate and discourse to be had between a government and its citizens to say what is an appropriate level of income that we wish to spend on official development assistance. I'm not sure I feel entirely comfortable with saying that needs to be legislated and outside of public debate. I personally, you know, would be very supportive of governments that committed to higher amounts. But I think it's also reasonable that a voter who thinks it should be less has the right to voice that. So I think that's kind of one interesting thing around, you know, that you raise about the level. But I think a second thing is, is this first point you raised, that kind of not thinking that much about what it's being spent on. And dare I say it, when it's being spent. And I think, you know, this comes back to this point of influence you raised. I suspect that back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when DFID was spending much less on aid than it has been over the past 5 years, it had much greater global influence, much greater respect, I think, from recipient countries in many respects. And I think it also used its aid budget potentially to lever the influence of others more effectively. So, you know, one good example of this is back in 2005 at the G7 summit, you know, a timely comparison, I suppose, with the summit coming up in a couple of weeks. Then at the time, the UK government was spending about 0.35% of its budget on ODA before the summit it had been. So it was a much, much smaller aid budget back then. But at that time, the commitments of the UK, you know, they essentially shot that budget up to about 0.5% in 2005, 2006 as a way to crowd in support from other countries to provide debt relief. You know, I think that's a much more kind of strategic way of thinking about the role of aid, rather than saying, okay, forever it needs to be this. It's right, you know, what are we trying to achieve with this? You know, how can we sort of, with our aid budget, get other countries, you know, come up with international agreements that make a difference, and thinking much more about the impact that money has. And I think that has just got lost out of discussions in the UK in recent times.
In terms of Norway being, you know, a good, solid welfare state, but also a small country that really needs to somehow feel important. You know, there's nothing better than doling out a lot of money. And every time, you know, we wish to get a seat at the table, obviously it helps to say, we'll provide the first billion in relation to whichever new initiative that Norway wants to support. So being that kind of a role model, you know, being exemplary in terms of being generous, all of that helps. And certainly I see your point, you know, about this dichotomy between being generous versus being impactful. But one of the things that I notice about the discourse in Britain is the kind of role that the media plays. And I've noticed, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's often this tendency to carry sensational headlines, sometimes misleading, about wastage, about corruption, mismanagement. And I remember one particular set of issues relating to cash transfer programs. I think this was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, cash transfers mm-hmm. that in the development discourse are considered to be a very important source of social protection in low-income country contexts. There were all of these news stories in Britain, I think it was these tabloid newspapers, that were typically portraying this as British taxpayer cash being freely given out for no good reason, whereas in reality, you know, everybody would say, or a lot of people would say, it actually helps children attend schools, you know, gets people, mm-hmm. families, regular health checkups. And some of these cash transfers are often conditional on recipient countries fulfilling certain obligations. So you have the news reports on the one hand, but then you also have politicians who may choose to deliberately misrepresent facts. Populist mm-hmm. leaders, not just in Britain, but all over the world, would try to justify cutbacks to aid by pointing to the need to promote more development within their own countries. Even in Norway, you know, we have a lot of money. We are pretty rich. There's always more that can be done for the healthcare system. You know, hospitals will always need more money to reduce the kind of queues that we have awaiting a simple surgery. So two issues I'd like you to please reflect on. One is the kind of general public opinion on aid effectiveness and the kind of moral obligation that the British public feels it has to help those that are less fortunate. That's one. And the second is, how has sort of this international development discourse found itself in the fault lines of changing political divisions in the UK?
Yeah, no, there's a big sort of societal questions there you raise. I think on the public view of aid, I think, you know, again, it's really interesting to chart this over time. So, you know, if you think back again to sort of mid-2000s, when the G7 summit was at Gleneagles, you're making poverty history, which was the sort of tagline, you know, and this was a movement that had, I think, widespread public support behind it. And, you know, the UK, there's also, you know, thinking back to, I suppose, even things like Live Aid, which, you know, had some deeply problematic aspects in the way that poverty were presented. But there has been this kind of history, I think, of, you know, in the past, of UK public support for providing financial assistance to countries, you know, beset by poverty or vulnerability. So historically, but in recent years, it's very clear that support has been waning, particularly under attack, I think, as you say, from parts of the right-wing media, where aid has found itself, I suppose, almost in the culture wars, where it is presented as essentially, you know, governments not doing enough to support those who are, you know, charity begins at home, mm-hmm. I guess, is the sort of underlying kind of message in a lot of this. And, you know, those kind of headlines you raised about cash transfers, you know, the Prime Minister almost directly alluded to this when he announced the merger between DFID and FCO, when he talked about the aid budget often being seen as a giant ATM in the sky, which, you know, it does not suggest, you know, he, you know, again, almost speaking directly to the concerns of, you know, the readers of this media, that no longer will the aid budget be used to give cash to people who happen to be, you know, just much, much less fortunate. Instead, you know, it will be directed, allocated much more in line with the interests of the people in the UK. And so alongside the Brexit negotiations and, you know, also negotiations of migration has found itself in, you know, this similar almost remaking of UK politics, where the divisions are no longer about just historical right and left, but also much more about, I suppose, internationalism and nationalism or cultural differences. And so aid has definitely found itself as part of that remaking of politics, if that makes sense.
You know, I was thinking about that famous song, you know, Feed the World, and the lyrics, do they know it's Christmas time?
Yeah.
And my children and I were actually listening to this during Christmas, last Christmas. Those words are just so politically incorrect. It's this idea that we are going to save the world, and it is mainly altruistic motives. I know that in Norway, these ideas have changed in the sense that I don't think there are too many people who think of themselves as saviors. There may be certainly some who think that way, but I think there is greater acceptance that we are all in the same boat, and that maybe we are a bit luckier than others. We won the lottery. You know, we have oil. We have all of this money that we can't always use up. So we have this moral obligation to share with those who are less better off than us. So I wonder how that kind of debate is being shaped, or the current discourse in Britain. Are there still these kind of altruistic motives, maybe sometimes outdated ideas of what it means to develop other countries, and maybe British solutions are the best, you know? So that could be one set of issues. The other, which I was thinking about, is also how you think the British public or even officials think about Britain's role in relation to, say, multilateralism. So on the one hand, of course, you have all of these countries that need saving, some would say, some countries that need financial transfers in the form of aid. But then there's also this whole big, huge arena of multilateral institutions and alliances that are extremely important for Britain in terms of maintaining and further strengthening diplomatic ties.
You know, I think certainly people who work in development, I think, you know, very much recognize that Live Aid, that kind of savior complex, they recognize how deeply problematic that is. I think two difficulties there have been in shaking some of that off. I think one difficulty has been that, you know, over the past 10 years, before, you know, the current Johnson government, one of the ways that the UK government continued to defend what was a massively increasing aid budget, even as the overall public spending was being quite drastically cut back because of austerity. The way that the government did that was to this enormous focus on the results agenda and thinking about, and that meant really sort of justifying each pound on visible results that could be delivered. And I think that often did have a tendency to sort of translate money into bums on seats in school, lives saved through drugs, lives saved, and almost sort of, I think almost built it, fed into that sort of savior narrative, the idea that, you know, if we can just spend more money, we can school more people, save more lives with that. And that was a bit of a departure from, you know, DFID in the sort of early 2000s, which I think had recognized that development is complex, as you say, perhaps, you know, relates to international systems, political challenges, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's one part of this. You know, one of the challenges of shaking off that sort of problematic Live Aid thinking, if you like. I think a second challenge is actually, I think there is quite a lot of skepticism around, you know, how the UK can support development, both, you know, from the right, as we've spoken about in some of the sort of media articles, but also in the left for, you know, some of these reasons. People find this savior narrative, colonial narrative, whatever we want to call it, deeply, deeply problematic. This idea that the UK knows what's best, how best to tackle poverty, not necessarily the people in the country you know, who are receiving that aid. I think a lot of people recognize that as deeply problematic, but it's very difficult to have an open, considered debate about that when you are in this sort of crossfire, this cultural war, to recognize how, you know, having an open discussion about how problematic certain aspects of, you know, the whole development endeavor are, is a really difficult thing to do when you're sort of also fighting against a front that essentially would be very happy if aid budget was reduced to much closer to zero, DFID closed, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it has been hard to have that open, more reflective discussion. But I think it's absolutely necessary in future, particularly for the political left, if they, you know, if they want a kind of more considered opposition to current UK policy and development, and considered opposition that has the support of the, you know, countries in the global south, then that absolutely has to take place. So that's on the live aid piece, if you like. On multilateralism, I think here there's probably a need to unpack a bit, you know, which sort of multilateral organizations we're talking about. I think it's very early to say, you know, as I say, there's much in this sort of global Britain that's still not really very clear. But there does seem to be some indications that the UK government will continue to be a strong supporter of, for example, the multilateral development banks, the World Bank, which are organizations that historically have had strong backing from the US. Certain of the aid cuts that have been announced seem to have been borne particularly hardly on the United Nations and some of the United Nations organizations. So we've heard about quite large cuts to UNFPA and UNICEF. And so does that perhaps indicate that the UK's future approach to multilateralism will be much more around trying to identify groups of like-minded, or what we consider to be like-minded powers working on common areas of interest, rather than a sort of more inclusive approach that brings all countries to the table? And this is going to be, seems to be particularly the case at the upcoming G7 summit, where, you know, really it will primarily be about who's not in the room instead of who's in it. So, you know, you've got the G7 group of wealthy nations. They've also invited certain democracies, or, you know, nominally democracies. So Australia, South Korea, South Africa and India. But I suppose China and Russia's absence will ring loud through discussions. And so there's perhaps a sense that the future direction of multilateralism, or the future of the UK's engagement in multilateralism, is to try and assemble like-minded partners, often perhaps potentially in sort of hardened opposition to other powers.
Some of this polarization that has taken place, not just in Britain, but also in many other parts of the world, including in the US, is related to the fact that, you know, there are left behind populations also in some of our countries. And I was reminded of a conversation I had on the show last season with Martin Sanbu from the Financial Times. And, you know, he's written this really excellent book, and we were discussing this, and he was telling me about how the political debate in the United States, also in Britain, in recent years has questioned the purpose and value of this established Western economic and political order that has been in place since 1945, but that is characterized by widening income inequality, you know, growing political polarization, populist leaders becoming more popular. Some people, of course, question globalization. So in all of this, people are thinking about themselves perhaps a bit more than thinking about being or showing forms of solidarity with distant strangers in distant lands. Martin's major argument was that the real problem for him was that the Western social order no longer fulfills its promise of an economy that provides a good place for everyone. That, you know, maybe some of this, perhaps, Mark, is leading to this kind of resentment, towards helping others, and, you know, this kind of an inward looking mentality, not just in your country, but also in mine. Mm-hmm. But moving on to the famous DFID merger with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, FCO. Tell us, please, tell me, tell my listeners, Mark, what are the arguments for and against this merger, which some would say has become very notorious? Obviously, I see certain advantages, you know, giving money, large sums of money can buy you influence. And this should definitely be seen as some sort of a conscious attempt to influence foreign policy. So it makes sense that these attempts at giving aid are coordinated with the Foreign Office. But then there are also many others, NGOs, international organizations in Britain, elsewhere, extremely worried. And we mentioned, we discussed this briefly in the introduction, that there are all of these reports documenting the potentially negative impacts of this merger. So give us a sense of the arguments for and against this merger.
One of the, I suppose, arguments for, perhaps links to that last point you made around, you know, the sort of Martin Sandu argument, which is a bit that there was often a sense that DFID has become almost an entity separate from the rest of the government. He almost had a different master. You know, its political masters were the High Church of Development rather than necessarily, you know, the political masters of the day who had been voted into power. And I think that can be potentially problematic if it's perceived that a country's international engagement or approach to development, approach to foreign policy, is totally divorced from domestic policy. And particularly where, you know, we saw this, you know, as I mentioned earlier, where spending was being cut at home while the aid budget was increasing. This created a lot of resentment about DFID. So I think one possible argument for the merger is by linking DFID to the Foreign Office, it becomes those links back, you know, from your development policy back to the domestic political debate become clearer. So I think that's one potential argument for. I think a second thing that needs to be borne in mind in all these discussions is that the DFID that was eventually merged in 2020 was a very different beast from the DFID that was set up back in 1997. I think when DFID had been set up in 1997, it was explicitly set up as a way of essentially moving beyond its predecessor, the Overseas Development Administration, which was seen primarily as an entity to administer aid projects. And you know, the idea behind DFID, or certainly Clare Short, who was the first Secretary of State, her clear vision for DFID was that it would be a Ministry of Development, and thinking much more explicitly about how policy levers across the whole of government affected development, the kind of systems change that might be needed to support development beyond just administering an aid project. And I think that was a, you know, quite a sort of inspiring vision for the ministry that won a lot of admiration. But by 2020, I think partly as a result of choices made by the governments in the previous decade, I do think sort of DFID's authority had been significantly eroded. It was primarily an aid delivery ministry, and a ministry delivering a declining proportion of overall government aid because a lot of aid was being bid for by other government departments. And so you had a ministry that was perhaps quite unpopular, and a ministry that was focusing primarily on the delivery of aid rather than those broader development issues. And so I think the eventual merger was perhaps an inevitability given how far DFID's authority had eroded, because it wasn't really able to it didn't have the same authority to work on the big global challenges that require cooperation across, you know, a whole series of ministries. Answers to, let's say, problems like global health, improving global health, are not just the responsibility of the development ministry or aid projects. They rely on research and development being done. That might be led by the health ministry. They rely on inputs from different ministries across government. And so the idea of having a more integrated approach to development is one that seems in principle, you know, a sensible way to thinking about addressing the big global challenges of the day. So that's perhaps in principle. Just one final thing to add to this is that obviously undertaking a merger like this is a big organizational undertaking, and doing that while you have this enormous, enormous, unprecedented scathing of the aid budget means that any potential benefits through a merger are very, very difficult to actually yield, because for the last 6 to 12 months, I think most people in that, you know, newly formed organization have just been thinking about the very difficult business of managing enormous aid cuts and trying to minimize the fallout of it. So I think it's also actually just a bit early to say, you know, ultimately whether pros will outweigh the cons, because I don't think they've really been given a chance to think about or focus on what the benefits of that might be up until now.
I was thinking, Mark, that maybe some of the Foreign Office mandarins are delighted that they have DFID and that whole budget under their control. And they would be, you know, excited at using aid maybe even more politically to gain influence in certain parts of the world. At the same time, I would imagine, and I'd like to hear your views, if you know of people who are working in development now in this merged department, I'm sure some of them must be highly demotivated. They must be wondering, you know, what is the purpose of life now? Or do you think some of them who were perhaps initially demotivated, have they changed their minds that maybe things aren't as bad as they thought it would be?
Well, I think it's very difficult to separate out, I think, the merger from just the broader sense of attack the department probably feels under, particularly with, you know, the cut. So I think the primary driver of demotivation right now is, I suspect, across the board, whether you're a mandarin or a, you know, an ex Foreign Office mandarin or ex DFID, when you're having to figure out or communicate that a country budget has been reduced by 50-60%, whatever your kind of the stripes you were wearing before, I think that's very, very difficult to swallow, to communicate to partners inside a country. I think there is, again, sort of the optimistic view of a, you know, in country, what a combined DFID and Foreign Office offer might look like, is that where DFID had been having to sort of manage large aid budgets with relatively tight sort of personnel budgets, a lot of that money was essentially being managed through contractors, you know, organizations, you know, third party organizations, consultancy organizations, NGOs. And so DFID had, in some senses, in recent years, been reduced a bit to a contractor of aid projects, a project manager. I mean, that's slightly unfair, but that did represent a lot of its work. I think what the potential opportunity from the merger is that you start to think about deploying UK expertise, both in the sort of, you know, the foreign policy with political understanding, negotiation, you know, that as alongside DFID's long-standing expertise in just thinking very, very carefully about what it takes to deliver aid effectively. That if you brought those things together, that actually you might be able to have quite a compelling offer. But I think, as you say, at the moment, I don't think many people are very optimistic about the prospects of actually delivering that, because there's just been this, you know, one attack after another, or that's the how it feels, I suspect.
Mark, as you pointed out earlier in the conversation, not everything is bad. I mean, there may be some good things coming out of it. And I think in this kind of debate that we find ourselves in, including our discussion today, we need to perhaps be a bit more optimistic and not just think about all the bad things. So I'm thinking about the fact that the British economy is doing pretty well. A lot of the fears about what would happen to the economy following Brexit perhaps hasn't come true, which is good. London is still very attractive for many private sector actors. The UK has a very extensive diplomatic footprint that very few countries in the world can match. You have a big security presence around the world, you know, all this G7, G20, NATO, your major stakeholder in the IMF. So there's a lot of things, you know, a lot of interesting, important, influential tools at the hands of leaders. But the question is, how will all of this be used in the future? So one issue I'd like to ask you is, from the British government perspective, what could the UK do more of, given that it has already undertaken this merger? What can it do more of? That's one. And finally, given that there has been these major cuts in aid, what can development practitioners do to adapt to this new situation?
So I think what can the UK government do more of? So, you know, I think it recently published sort of integrated review, which sets out at a high level, its plans around foreign policy. And it hasn't yet translated into detail what that might mean for development. But I do think there are certain opportunities. I think, you know, one area where the UK government can clearly continue to play a leading role is in the whole area of global health. As you say, it's assets in terms of research expertise, so not just the COVID vaccine, but there's recently been trials suggesting that Oxford Jenner Center might have a malaria vaccine. I mean, these are quite game changing. Potentially, the global benefits of such things are enormous.
And especially the malaria vaccine. You know, when I read the news, I was absolutely thrilled.
Yeah, and you think that, so, you know, and if you think about the kind of whole of the UK ecosystem on this, so you think about the, you know, the research capacities to develop that vaccine, you think of quite a long history of actually working with governments to strengthen health systems, not just around sort of logistical, how do we get vaccine from A to B, but thinking about, okay, what does it take for effective staffing of a health system, and sort of long-term partnerships with governments thinking about strengthening health systems. The UK can really proudly point to that. It's work through multilateral agencies in the health sphere, that, you know, whether that be the WHO, but also organizations like Gavi, where you could think, okay, well, how can we sort of rapidly upscale this and deploy this? So, you know, that's one example of where you think of the suite of kind of UK assets where it could really continue to make major global contributions. Another one is on climate change. I think the UK can point very credibly to its own commitments, but also the climate finance it's provided, if, you know, it doesn't continue to undermine that by sort of cutting aid elsewhere. Then I think, again, you know, climate change, and with COP26 coming up, is an area where the UK can continue to demonstrate leadership. So I think there's certain global challenges where I think the UK can do more of. I think another area that's interesting but requires further fleshing out is around, there does seem to be a shift in language suggesting that the UK is going to concentrate more actively in thinking about how it can develop shared prosperity. So not just reducing, you know, not just poverty reduction, but actually thinking about, okay, well, is there ways that with, let's say, certain regions like East Africa, where the UK has clearly stated its continued commitment, can it develop a strategy beyond just thinking about, okay, let's provide aid to the region, but also how it brings investment, whether it's through its development finance, you know, whether it's through CDC, how it combines its expertise to actually have a more compelling industrial offer in that region. And I think that's something that UK's historically struggled with, because it doesn't have the same, I suppose, economic model as a country like Germany or Japan, where banks, industries, government have historically worked closer together. But I think there are some interesting questions around, is there a more coherent combined UK offer on supporting greater prosperity beyond just the provision of aid that, you know, would be interesting to get more detail on, and that's worth looking out for. So that's the what could it do more of. Sorry, the second question you asked, Dan.
What can development practitioners do to adapt to this new reality?
Yeah, so I think that's, you know, another excellent question. I think it is important. It's clearly important that the UK is still held to account on around official development assistance, and particularly at this moment. I think there is the hope that the government will still step up more to support a global response to the crisis. I think that's in the UK government's interest right now. I think if it wants to demonstrate leadership at, you know, G7, COP26, constraining itself by this 0.5% target is clearly very unhelpful for the global recovery, but I also think for, you know, the UK's reputation. But longer term, I do think this focus on aid as a number has become slightly unhelpful, and I do think a broader perspective on holding the UK government to account on its own, you know, on its own terms, is how it's presented itself as being a, in inverted commas, a force for good in the world beyond just the aid budget is really, really important. And so, you know, what might be some examples of that? Well, one thing development practitioners might be wanting to think about is, okay, we've seen the benefits of vaccine, you know, research and development of vaccines. Could the UK government be doing more around research and development on climate change, building on its research and development on, you know, global health? So, you know, what is it about the R&D budget, not necessarily just the aid budget, that we need to be thinking about? What processes are in place? How does that money get, oh, and expertise get used to channel towards working on the greatest development challenges of our age, and not just, for example, expanding UK military prowess? So I think, you know, that's kind of one idea. I think, if, you know, picking up on what I was saying around this idea of the UK as an economic, you know, what's its economic offer in, let's say, you know, the East Africa region. I think here, again, there's a role for development practitioners to perhaps look at the sort of coherence of a UK offer on shared prosperity. Is this just about, you know, removing barriers to trade, or is there something in this that actually, you know, a coherent logic on how UK trade and investment will create the jobs, the right kind of jobs, what, you know, what the benefits will be for the economies, how that will translate into development, how that links back to the UK economy. And again, not just thinking about numbers on aid. There are a couple of things. You must have others, Dan.
Well, you know, I do have one final issue that I'd like to discuss with you, Mark, and that has to do with when you mentioned shared prosperity. It sounded very Chinese to me, and I kept thinking, you know, and I'd like to ask you this. Do you think there is this feeling that maybe the UK is caught up in this great power competition between China and the United States, that some of the initiatives that you mentioned, for example, the UK Africa Summit that got a lot of attention early last year, and then there are more attempts, or more recent attempts, I suppose, to cultivate stronger ties with India. Do you think all of these attempts are some way related to addressing this great power competition, that the UK has to forge a new path, and that there are all of these opportunities for bilateral relationships that can be renewed and resurrected and strengthened?
I think that is clearly part of it. I think some of this goes back to what we were discussing around this, you know, historically slightly problematic, paternalistic view of development that there has been, I think, in the UK. I think one of the, you know, the things about the Chinese development model, I think that makes it potentially so popular in many countries, is that, you know, it's not just about transfer of funds. It's win-win. Yeah,
right?
And there's a vision, isn't there, about, you know, if you look at Belt and Road, about creating markets, around investing in prosperity, potential job creation. And China, when China goes to a country, it goes not just with the foreign aid ministry, but with a swathe of actors that are talking about investments. And I suppose the UK could look at that quite enviously and think, well, is this something we could be thinking about replicating? But I suspect that the problem with that is that, do we necessarily have the capabilities, the industrial structure, the right, and the same interests of UK citizens to present, a similar offer? Or should we actually be focusing more on the things where we are potentially good at, where we can make a difference, and not try and ape, necessarily a Chinese approach, but, set out a distinctive British approach? And, and I think global health is one quite good example of that. Could the UK actually be doing more to export its expertise, its both in terms of, research and development, but also manufacturing capabilities? So, I suppose there's the charitable view, or the sympathetic view would be that the focus on China could actually be quite a positive thing if it takes some of the right lessons away from it. The worrying view is it's more about just trying to split the world into different blocks and winning over favour. And I hope we get a bit more of the former and worry a bit less about the latter.
Mark, it was great fun to chat with you today. Thanks so much for coming on my show.
Thanks very much, Dan. Great to speak. Cheers now.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is Global Dev Pod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.